Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Alaskans consume more alcohol per capita than most other Americans, 4.14 gallons per person, compared with an average of 2.86 gallons in the rest of the country. And along with that higher consumption rate is a higher rate of alcohol-related crimes and accidents. Alcohol abuse and measures to control alcohol, including the state's local option law, were among the topics for discussion at the 16th Annual Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives, held in late October 1982 in Anchorage.
The cost in wasted lives has become too much to ignore.
AFN President and State Senator Frank Ferguson of Kotzebue.
64% of the criminal justice cases in 1980 were for alcohol-related offenses. Alaska spent over $280 million on alcohol in 1980, $280 million that could have been better spent. The estimated loss of income to Alaskan families with head of households who abuses alcohol was well over $77 million in 1980. The Department of Health and Social Services has stated that the villages that have voted dry, trooper and village public safety officers' calls for alcohol-related violence have greatly decreased. That in itself is something to be proud of. As a tribute to those villages who have exercised their local option law banning alcohol in their villages, AFN will not sponsor any activity which includes alcohol during this convention.
In 1980, the Alaska State Legislature passed the Alcohol Local Option Law, giving villages four alternatives for controlling the importation and sale of alcohol. Since that time, the following notice has been posted on many community bulletin boards around the state.
State of Alaska, Notice of Local Liquor Option Election. Notice is hereby given that pursuant to the provisions of AS 04.11.500 and AS 04.11.502, an election will be held in the village to vote on the following question. Shall the sale and importation of alcoholic beverages be prohibited in the village? Yes or no?
In the past 2 years, the vote has been overwhelmingly yes. Daisy May Lamont is the executive director of ANCATA, the Alaska Native Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse.
I can recall 2 years ago, our elderly people were voicing that they wanted to ban the importation of alcohol. And within 2 years' time, 50 villages enforced this and found the result that 60% crime rate is working because of banning the importation local option law.
Although there are four options under the law, including establishing a village-owned liquor store, banning the sale of alcohol within the community, allowing the sale of alcohol, and banning importation even for personal use, as Northwest Arctic Native Association President John Schaefer says.
Oh, there's only one option as far as we're concerned. All the rest of them allow liquor.
8 of the 11 villages in the Nana region have voted that option in, prohibiting the importation and sale of alcohol in the community. Kotzebue is one of the exceptions, but even there, Nana closed the bar in the corporation-owned hotel, though the hotel as a whole lost about $200,000 in 1981, while the lounge had profits of $90,000. John Schaefer.
Our elders asked that we do this as an indication of our support for the fight against alcohol abuse, and so we did it. Alcohol is not the problem. It's one of the symptoms, but it's there's just so much damage done to people when alcohol is there, that even if we didn't solve the problem right away, we at least took the symptom away. In terms of community well-being, it's made a tremendous difference. There's much less crime, there's much less beatings and I think even things like the accident and suicide rates are down. The people are more positive. They are looking for good things to do as opposed to just laying around and drinking.
Was there a need for legislation to accomplish this?
Well, I think at this time, yes. Maybe 30 or 40 years ago, we may not have needed legislation to do it. But I think Western system, the systems that have been imposed on us, have taken away our will to do anything on our own. And, we've become dependent on outside controls to make us move in different directions, and it's taken this kind of an option to do it. The people still, of course, have to vote for it. So when they vote in favor of the option, they're indicating their desire to do something about the liquor abuse problem, but when they do get it, then the ball's back in their hands, and they have to themselves enforce the law, and this is where they're having difficulty. The help is not coming from the outside to do that, but it's just a matter of time. There's just too many positive things that have occurred since the option has been voted out of those villages, and I don't think we'll ever go back to the way it was before.
However, at least one village has gone back. After several months of not permitting liquor to be brought into the community or sold there, voters changed their minds and voted to return to the former status. And as John Schaefer said, for those villages who have voted the option in, there are problems of interpretation and enforcement.
Mainly because some of the law officers are indulging continuing to indulge, or they sympathize with the drinkers, so they're not enforcing the laws very well, and the people are having a difficult time getting used to not being able to have liquor around.
In late September 1982, a jury deliberated 3.5 hours before finding a former Alaska state trooper guilty of importing alcohol into a community that had voted the local option in. The trooper was charged with importing 127 cans of beer into the village, where he lived and worked. The defense attorney argued that the privacy provisions of the Alaska State Constitution gave the man the right to drink in his home. The motion was denied at the hearing, but the privacy issue is often raised. Renewed interest in home brew isn't an issue or an apparent problem yet, but bootlegging is.
Among those who absolutely can't live without it, there's that necessity. And they're making a vast array of trips to wherever necessary to try to secure some. And unfortunately, some very nice people are succumbing to the lure of bootlegging.
Willie Hensley.
Because of its potential. Just like anywhere else in the world, there's a demand. Somebody's going to try to provide it.
Ancata's Daisy Mae Lamont.
We're dealing with business people that make money. Alaskan, bootleggers. And with something that involves money, we'll try to stick regardless of the law. However, the people are strong enough to implement the law.
But as Lamont admits, each village implements the law in its own way and its own style, ranging from a strict enforcement to laissez-faire. Franklin Madros is a community leader in the Yukon River village of Caltag. Officially, Caltag has voted to ban alcohol, a position Madros supports due to his own experience, though he doesn't expect his kids to go along.
I used to drink a lot myself, and I know a lot about alcohol. I know what it could do to you, really. One time I quit drinking for 7 years, but after 7 years I started again. And Philip told me if I start drinking after 7 years, it's going to be worse than I was before, and which it was. And doggone it, it almost killed me. I almost died from it. I didn't have to go to the doctor to tell me that. I had the feeling that I was getting pretty weak, and it got down to the point where it got too bad. So I just decided to quit again, and that's about 6 or 7 years ago now. And I feel better without it. Just like at home, you know. All my kids are drinking too, but there's no party. No party going on in my house at no time. They're not allowed to. So they know that. They go somewhere else to party.
And do you think that by outlawing alcohol that all those problems will be solved?
Well, you know, you cannot solve the alcohol problem, really, you know. When I was a kid, you know, it was tried before. They were trying to, you know, go dry in the state of Alaska a long time ago, you know, when we were territory. But then it didn't work out too well. You know, a drinking guy will always find a way to find his booze, you know. So you cannot really dry up a village, you know. There'll be some drinking, all right, you know, but what we're trying to do is try to slow it up to some degree, you know.
Have you personally known people who have died or had serious accidents because they were drinking?
Oh, there has been, yeah. Oh, yeah. Even in Nulato or Caltech, you know, I'm pretty familiar with Nulato people. You know, I have a lot of relatives up there and friends. And there are a lot of people died of the result of drinking. You know. That's what makes me think it's pretty bad.
You said that the enforcement's going to be a problem. By having people in town trying to enforce their own people, isn't that going to be really hard?
It is really hard even to deal with that problem with your own people. It's really hard, you know, because you got 50-50 there, chance, you know, some for it and some against it, you know. When they start that petition with and the vote came out pretty close, you know, to stay with, but a little margin that it went dry.
Franklin, how far away from Caltech is the nearest liquor store?
Let's see, it must be about 53 miles. It's just above Nulato. And heck, that's not very far, you know. You got fast boats and fast snow machines in wintertime, so you can really go up there pretty fast. You know, that 53 miles isn't very far if you want booze.
And that not too far away liquor store is called The Last Chance. Phil Tudiakoff of Unalaska doesn't feel too optimistic about the implementation of the local option law in the Aleutian-Pribilof region. He said that when the state sent people to St. Paul to explain the law, very few attended. Many were out of town at a fisheries meeting. When an election was held, the village voted not to ban liquor. According to Tudiakoff, the success of the local option law in his area depends on population changes and the fishing industry.
There aren't very many Aleuts, so the transient workers who work in the processors, the fishermen, when they become qualified voters, then the Aleut becomes a minority. And for that reason, I don't believe many of our communities will exercise the option.
Some who vote against the option do so because they feel it restricts their personal freedom of expression, even though those expressions may have unpleasant consequences. Former state senator Willie Hensley of Nana calls alcohol evil and damaging and defends the need for the local option law.
I think it's a necessary step. If people agree that they're too weak to handle this substance, then perhaps they feel better off in eliminating from their presence till they can build themselves up. But to me, alcohol or anything else is like a weapon. You don't have to use it on yourself. So I think it's a healthy movement, but it's only a symptom. This alcohol thing is a symptom of other problems when we, frankly, need to toughen up our individual selves and families and communities, you know, to not require that substance.
This has been a report on Alaska's alcohol local option law that permits villages to decide the method and degree, if any, of local alcohol sales and importation. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
What is Dugak Theater?
First of all, we are a theater school for Greenlanders, Kalaalleq, the only professional native theater school that exists in this world.
Ryder Nielsen is the artistic director of the Tukak Theater. He's a Norwegian actor working for the group of Greenlandic Inuit who have their school and center in Denmark. The group toured Alaska recently, giving performances around the state, both formal ones and informal presentations like the one we're hearing, for a group of junior high school students in Fairbanks in the school gym. Before the actors began, Nielsen introduced the play, a play about Tupileks.
In the old times, they were created by a sorcerer and had one function. That function was to kill. Well, you are used to that. You are used to that in the television. You are used to that reading all these magazines, yes? This is another play. What you will see is Makka in the white dress. She is a sorcerer.
I always wanted to be an actor, I guess, as far as I can remember from childhood. But in the 60s, there was a policy of sending away children, Greenlandic children, to schools in bigger towns and also to Denmark. So I was sent to Denmark when I was 12 years old to learn Danish and Danish way of living, and to a totally strange family. And so I went to school there, and when they asked me what I want to be, I said, I want to be an actor. And they laughed at me, because how could a Greenlander, a native, with a look like me, brown eyes, black hair, you know, how can I become an actor? So I didn't forget it, but I never told anyone about that since that, until 77, when I saw Dugak Theater in Greenland. At that time, I went to college, teacher training college, and then I finished my education and joined the group.
It happened. We received some visitors from a foreign world. They were very different from us. They believed in some strange things. And some of them didn't even believe in what they were supposed to believe in.
What started Dugak?
Yes, a dinner party. It started in this. I came to Denmark 10 years ago, and as an actor from Norway. I'm a Norwegian, and I was invited to a dinner in a Greenland community house very soon after I come to this town, in the town of Holstebro in Denmark. And I stayed there for a couple of years. While working at the theater, I worked with some people in the house. Unemployed, some of them were so-called social losers, as you find many native people going around. Very often those are the people those people who cannot fit into society are very often artists, painters, musicians, actors. They have a lot of talents, and they just cannot fit into a square society. So we put up a small piece just for entertainment to the fifth anniversary of the house. And the reaction on that little piece gave the idea to Dugak. So we decided to take a 16-month period and train a group on a professional level. And that's 8 years ago.
We look at it in Denmark in a very small village, about 200 people, farmers. We have an old farm which we rebuilt, and we have our own little universe there. So we don't, we feel like we live in our own country.
The place that you were from in Greenland, what kind of community was that?
My place was a coal mine town, which was closed by the Danish government and the by the approval of the local Greenlandic government. In 1972, there were about 1,500 people living there. They closed it, and everyone had to move. So I feel like I have nowhere in Greenland to be.
I was also sent to Denmark same year as Mecca, and we lived about 9 kilometers. Never saw each other, only one time I remember. I come from a fisher town, western part of Greenland, middle western part of Greenland, and I'm also educated teacher. I teach in 3 years and recorded radio for children in three years too. So I sung a lot.
This is from a performance of Catoota during the 16th Annual Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives in Anchorage. In singing and monologues, the performers tell of changes in the culture of the Greenlandic Inuit, the subject of many of their productions.
We have to recognize that in Denmark, we are living in Denmark, we are a kind of a minority theater. And as such, we have two functions. One is a function that Maka described by meeting Dugak in 77. She described the pride she felt. And this is one of the main items within the minority to again awaken the pride. And the other is to show to the majority society that there are values that they would do wise in listening to. I think a theater like ours could be a bridge between the old way of thinking and the new time. And this is a third point, which it's really been a hard fight to be recognized as actors at a theater, and not a native theater, not a Greenlandic theater, not an Inuit theater, but a theater, and be judged upon the quality of a work for the quality, not because it's made by native people.
Do you think that's partly because of the nature of the material that you do? You don't do Strindberg and Ibsen and Chekhov?
We do, for instance, we have done Arabian Nights. It's nothing to do with Greenland. It's as far away from Greenland as we can come. We do modern things. We do cabaret pieces. We have done modern dance. I mean, we can do anything. But what we are doing is what is in our mind, what lies close to our heart.
Like Catoota.
Catoota was made. It wasn't any intention at the beginning. It wasn't meant to be a performance. It was just a homework which a writer gave us. He said, write a poem and put music to it. And some goes, you know, oh no, I can't, you know, I can't write a poem. Oh well, you can, everybody can. So everybody wrote a poem about the reality today. What the task was, what do you think your reality today is, or the realities you face? And it just turned out to be a story. when all the songs came, gradually we could see a story in the songs. So everybody gave a song to the performance. And what we did was just to link them together with some few words.
Tell them and say, I'll pick me a wife that has so wide, round and the shape. If I don't get her, I will never marry, because I'm a man that easily falls apart.
When you perform for different groups, say you were just in Bethel and down in that area, what is the difference when you perform for, say, a native audience as opposed to a junior high school kids in Fairbanks?
For Inuit or Ketuta, I think in small places, when we play for almost entirely native people, the reactions are much stronger, much more impulsive than the nice, tame, big city audience. It's like they used to go to theater and they sit down and then they look and then they leave and say, how interesting, it was nice. But it's some totally, some people, but it's that's many people's attitude when they come to theater in big towns. It's to have fun, to see something interesting. But in small places, they react much more. And many times they laugh at some things that we don't think are funny, you know. The reactions are very different.
There are another difference too, and this has to do with the politics. Yeah. And that is that when the majority of the audience is native, it's much more immediate identification. You associate with the team right away and say, oh, this is not only a, quote, Greenlandic performance, this is my performance too. This deals with all problems too. When we play in big cities, we sometimes we have sophisticated audiences, as Maka says, and they judge it out of, like it was a ballet or a dance or something like that. And that's okay in one sense. Other urbanized people get a bit offended sometimes by the performance because they feel that we are coming to take the ground under their feet, away under their feet. We had quite some reaction like that in Bethel, for instance, by the white people in Bethel. Some of them got really mad at the performance because they really thought that we were fighting the white man. And how the hell, can I sit here as a director fighting myself? Our performances deal with really universal matters, deals with the kind of oppression, deals with the necessity of fight if you really want to live, just not exist or exploit, but live.
I think first of all we have to rebuild our own belief in ourselves, to regain the wisdom that our forefathers had, which was by the colonizers and by the church was made as, something heathen and it's uncivilized, it's not good. I think it's one of the ways to get the pride of people is by theater, by standing there, be proud of what you are, who you are, and also be aware of that you have something you can give, share with other people. Maybe you can tell the so-called civilized world something.
Tukak Theater, performers from Greenland. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to a special edition of Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller, and co-producer for this program is Brad Reeve of KOTZ in Kotzebue. This summer, Brad visited reindeer dehorning camp with tape recorder in hand. Here's his story.
On Seward Peninsula, an hour's boat ride from Kotzebue, is Riley Wreck, named for where a sidewheel steamship sank over 80 years ago. More recently, it's a corral for America's largest reindeer herd. And on one of our long summer days, I hitched a ride out to reindeer camp on one of the boats bringing herders and volunteer workers supplies from Kotzebue. It was a chilly, misty morning, and our excitement wasn't quite enough to keep us warm, being we put on our parkas before we were halfway there. Approaching the beach, we could see the camp, a small tent village, and that the work of counting, tagging, inoculating, and dehorning had already started. At the corral site, people shouted and laughed while the reindeer snorted and grunted as they were pushed through wooden chutes or milled around in various holding pens. The reindeer sounded like pigs, but they looked like a smaller version of their relatives, the caribou, and as Chief Herder Doug Sheldon explains, they're a lot tamer.
A reindeer is a domestic animal, and it's not like caribou. It's not wild. It could be, you know, handled easier than you can handle caribou. It could get used to a person pretty easy. You can make sled deers out of them if you just work at it. And they're not mean animal. They don't run over anybody.
How do you feel about being chief herder? What is it like for you to do that year round?
Well, it's what I wanted to be. Work with the reindeer, and I enjoy it lots to be out in the country and with the reindeer. It's a lot of work, a lot of, you know, most of the time, but a lot of times we were, you know, you just work and play out there. So being out in the country is what we look for, I guess, and it doesn't bother, you know. The work doesn't bother anything.
The scene looked chaotic, thousands of reindeer, all horns and hooves, with 50 or so people all working hard. To make some sense of all the activity, I wandered around asking questions of anyone who had a moment to talk.
Let me just finish cutting this thing through, and then I won't be puffing while I'm doing it.
What's your name?
Okay, I'm Bob Dietrich, veterinarian, and here with some students from the university that are assisting with treating these animals.
What types of things are you doing?
Well, in case anybody's wondering, I'm cutting a fence right now. That's the reason I'm puffing. So as I cut the fence, I'll tell you. We're treating all the reindeer with a drug that'll kill their intestinal parasites and the lungworms. And so each animal that's an adult is getting an injection. And so we have four students that are either in veterinary school someplace in the United States or going to be attending veterinary school in the United States that are getting some experience out here helping out.
What are the parasites like that you're dealing with reindeer?
Well, we've got several types. As I said, this particular drug we're using is effective for the internal parasites in the stomach and the lungworms. And then if you look at the backs of some of those adults over there, you'll see big scars. This calf by. You see some big scars on their backs, and that's a warble fly scar. And this fall we'll be actually treating all the reindeer for that. So hopefully here in the next, let me get this fence back now. Hopefully in the next 6 months or so we're going to cut down the parasite load on these animals a great deal.
How does it affect the animals?
Well, I think you can see as they come through the chute, the ones that have these parasites on their back and all are really thin looking. You know, they're weak, emaciated, a lot of infections with pus on the back. So it's a real debilitating problem with them. I'll bend down again here and finish this job.
Is this something that's common to all reindeer? This is a natural parasite?
On the Seward Peninsula here, all the reindeer have this parasite, and we do have a drug that's effective in treating it, and it hasn't been used in the past because it's taken some work to get it approved by the Food and Drug Administration and to get it purchased. The particular drug we're going to use in the warbles this fall comes all the way from Finland, so it'll be shipped in, and it's been a real job trying to get it coordinated to get the drug over here and get it through customs. They had production difficulties in producing the drug, and so it's gone around in circles.
Why is it coming from Finland?
Just because that's where they have the plant that can make this particular product. There's no place in the United States, you know, as you can imagine, there's not an awful big demand for reindeer drugs in the lower 48, so we have to go to where we can get them. How's that working out there, Willie? You want a gate or just leave it open? Okay, we'll just leave it there. Now you see these little fawns here, now that I can pay attention to what's going on, I'm not working as I'm talking. As some of them come through, they've broken the tips of their antler, and we cut those off and put some disinfectant on it and a fly repellent, because if they're not cut off and they bother them a lot, they'll shake their head and they've got this thing flopping on the top of their head. And so a small percentage of them have that problem, and by treating it, we'll take care of it. They're also getting an ear tag in their ear for identification, and they're getting the tip of their ear notched for identification. And then off they go to find their mother again, and all of the deer as they come out now are being held in this one big field out in front of us toward the ocean. And there we'll keep them until all the deer are done to make sure that the fawn gets back with its mother. If you just turn them loose, you know, the mother can take off and be 5 miles away by the time the fawn comes out of the corral, so that can be a problem.
Working with animals is something that from which you can derive a great deal of satisfaction, so I suppose I spend more time and get more involved than I actually should, but it is something I enjoy. It's the one part of our business that really gives me a lot of satisfaction. You not only working with the animals, but with the herders that we have working with them.
Taking a reindeer break from his duties as president of Nana Regional Corporation is John Schaefer. Nana owns this herd of about 8,000 and gives it a home on about 5 million acres of range. The hope is that the reindeer will reduce reliance on the subsistence use of caribou.
We looked at the various uses that our stockholders had traditionally, and one of the resource uses is of the caribou that roam wild up here. And after taking a close look at it, we saw the great dependence that our stockholders had on the caribou and the limited resource that was there and the lack of control we had over the management. Our objective is to eventually have enough reindeer in our herds to provide enough meat for local consumption, regardless of whether they're allowed to take caribou or not. As far as our investment here, we figured it was a long-term investment, and that until our herds became of sufficient size to produce a lot of meat for the market, they wouldn't even break even. But since the horn market has developed, we've been able to get enough of an income where it makes it a lot easier for us now to develop the herd.
The horn market John Schaefer referred to brought $250,000 to Nana last year. Korean merchants pay about $30 a pound for reindeer antlers, which are ground up with ginseng and other herbs. The Koreans say it's a medicine. Rumor here says it's an aphrodisiac. In any case, the dehorning is the main purpose for this summer roundup.
As the guys grab the reindeer and hold it, I clip the antlers off of the animal, and then it's stacked so that the blood is contained inside the antlers and then covered with Visqueen so they stay dry.
Now, these animals, a lot of people probably don't realize, but they grow new horns every year.
Yeah, they do. And they both grow them earlier than the females do. Even the newborn fawns grow their antlers.
How would you describe an antler?
Well, it's covered with a furry material called velvet, and inside it's kind of a spongy material. That's ideally that's what she's spongy with quite a bit of blood left in it. They call it this part right here. Kind of see the porous nature of it. They call that honeycomb. That's what they like to see.
That's what the buyers are looking for when they buy antler.
Right, antler with blood inside and a kind of spongy honeycomb texture.
Now, does this hurt the animals? What's the material like on the, that the horn's made out of?
You mean when the antlers are cut? I guess I can tell you that I really don't know for sure, but just looking at how they act and so forth, it doesn't seem to be highly innervated. They seem to come through it, you know, as you can see, in pretty good shape. The thing that we're trying to really minimize is actually just the stress of bringing them in. That's what I feel is, you know, where we need all the help we can get, is to not let them get real worried as they come in and get heated up and excited. Just be calm with them and take it easy. Not rushing them, in other words, just treating them like all of us would like to be treated.
That was Robert Dietrich, the vet again. He keeps the animals healthy, and that means more animals with better meat and, who knows, perhaps tastier horns. That's something I didn't get to ask the Korean buyers even after I saw them drink fresh blood from a newly cut horn. Although no one had envisioned a horn market when reindeer were first introduced to the Seward Peninsula in the 1890s to provide a stable source of meat, the experiment flourished in the 20s when there were over 200,000 reindeer on the peninsula. But after the meat market dwindled during the Depression and overgrazing and parasites took their toll, the herd was reduced to 20,000. Nana is steadily improving the herd once again. Anticipated revenue from reindeer antlers could reach $5 million in the next 5 or 6 years. And if you consider that frozen hamburger from Seattle costs $4.10 a pound in the villages, while reindeer meat is $1.10, then reindeer herding looks like good business. And it's not a bad way to spend a few days.
Sometimes it's hard work and sometimes it's easy.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you have to work without sleeping. Sometimes when you have to do it. Last time we, 27 hours we stayed awake on these here when we drive this way.
How come you're down here? Do you like being down here?
Oh, I love it. Can't miss it, except for last year. I had to, but nobody's going to miss the reindeer herding.
Is this something you get paid for coming down to it?
No way. We just like to do it because it's fun.
I think we get paid 3 Cokes an hour and a couple sandwiches on every 4-hour break, something like that.
Just a big roundup, I guess. It's exciting.
Been around reindeer herding now for about 3 years.
How do you feel about it?
I think it's the livestock industry in Alaska this time that has the most potential. Actually, it seems to be something that's compatible with the region. It's one animal that can live year round here without having supplemental feeding, which is a real problem with trying to develop cattle industry in Alaska. And of course, the country out here is real beautiful and really a unique activity for the United States.
From the 1980 Summer Reindeer Corralling, I'm Brad Reeve in Kotzebue.
And you've been listening to Chinook, produced with the help of KOTZ. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.